Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head to head. So you'll be
happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to the Change Agent's Dilemma for Tuesday, January 17th, 2012. I'm your host, Heather Stagel, coming to you live from Atlanta, Georgia, as I do once a month on Blog Talk Radio. This show is one of the many ways I help equip individuals to lead organizational change at Enclaria. The Change Agent's Dilemma is how to influence change without authority, and my goal with this show is to provide ideas and share stories to help you do just that. Today, my guest is Al Pittenpolly, who is here to talk about how to host meetings that drive change. Al Pittenpolly is a meeting culture warrior. He helps organizations transform meetings, make decisions, and embrace change. His book, Read This Before Our Next Meeting, was the most popular Kindle book in the world during the week of its release. Later, it was selected as one of 11 top business books of 2011. Al, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Heather.
So meetings get a lot of bad flack, and so I just want to start by asking, you know, is that deserved? Are meetings really that bad?
Yeah, I think they are, and I don't think it's for the reasons why people say they're so bad. I mean, you know, I talk to people all the time about meetings, of course, and they'll rattle off a list of complaints, like they're too long and they're too boring and there's too many people there. And that's important, and those are some of the contributing reasons that meetings are bad. But I think why meetings are fundamentally bad is because we don't really know what they are for. There's no clear purpose for a meeting. It's kind of this instrument that we use for everything and everything. So I think it's that lack of direction, it's this lack of understanding what a meeting can be that really leads to so much frustration.
So it's really the default way of working together in an organization, it seems like.
Exactly. I mean, you know, we call every time people get together in a room, that's a meeting, you know. In fact, I actually give speeches at conferences and corporate events, and they call those meetings. You know, 300 people in a room, and that's a meeting. So I guess there's a real challenge, because anytime you limit your vocabulary in any realm, you limit your power, because when you limit your ability to distinguish, well, this is this and this is that, then you kind of treat everything the same. And so what I've done in a lot of my work is to try to understand what exactly is a meeting, what isn't a meeting, and let's kind of enrich our vocabulary on what different things are in order to help us understand them.
Okay. So what's wrong with the way that most organizations conduct meetings?
Well, I would say that the primary, and there's many answers to that question, but I'd say the primary answer to that question is that for the longest time, the meeting, I would argue, was used as a decision-making tool. So when there's something important to be resolved, or an issue that needs to be decided on, the classic scenario is you gather all the people in the room that it affects and you try to make a decision. And that sounds like a great idea. It's the most democratic approach. It's the most logical approach. I mean, six heads are better than one. But the fundamental problem with that approach is that it leads to compromise and delay. Because anytime you get a bunch of people together in a room, there's this diffusion of responsibility that happens. In fact, I always say that the meeting has become the default stalling tactic for important decisions, because because my decision quickly becomes our decision as soon as we get into the room, so there's no accountability. And because of that, you know, nobody is willing to step up, and so you get meetings that turn into meetings because nobody's willing to really make a decision or take control. And you also get safe, watered-down, boring decisions that don't lead to change, don't lead to innovation, because only champions do that. Only people, the individual who are willing to take accountability and show leadership, can really make that happen. And I think the meeting is basically a place where that stuff is absent.
So meetings become a way of avoiding risk. And
yeah. If you think about it, you know, for the last 50 years or so, that's been the name of the game. I mean, in the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, we had these big companies, these big factories that were making lots of money in industries where it wasn't nearly as competitive as it is today, of course. You know, that was kind of the name of the game. Let's avoid risk. Let's avoid making mistakes. And so the meetings kind of served a purpose for a while because it made sure that with lots of approvals and lots of committees and endless meetings, you made sure that, you know, it's really hard to make big mistakes when you do that. And I'm arguing that maybe the meeting served a purpose for another time, but certainly now in such a hyper-competitive, dynamic environment, we have to completely rethink and reinvent what a meeting is.
When you say that we bring people together in order to make a decision, and it seems like we do that in the name of buy-in, getting buy-in, even. I mean, when we talk about organizational change, you know, getting all the people in a room who it affects so we can hear what their point of view is. But it sounds like that may not be a good idea.
Well, I think buy-in is an interesting thing because, you know, I think that's very separate from the decision-making process, or it's only one piece of the decision-making process. For example, you can get buy-in for a decision that you make unilaterally. I mean, there are times where there's a decision that might need to be made quickly, and you might know how to do it. And in the interest of the organization, you might need to make that decision. Now, that doesn't mean that was absent buy-in. That means that that's the next step. The next step is to go to individuals that this affects and really get them to understand what that decision was about and why, and really defend that decision to them. Now, that's not always the right scenario because a lot of times people need to contribute to decisions and it's wise to get people's opinions and stuff like that. But I think we've gotten so concerned with kind of the politics and upsetting people. And we've used buy-in, that term, almost as a shield to prevent us from making tough decisions, you know, because you can always make the excuse, well, you know what, I can't get buy-in for it, so I guess I shouldn't make that decision. And that's a problem because what we see in organizations is that the primary way that innovation happens is through champions, somebody who's willing to step up and defend a difficult cause. So I think that instead of thinking about buy-in as something that, you know, has to happen, it's something that you get a chance to get. You know, it's something that it's your job to make it happen.
Mm-hmm. And at least it doesn't have to happen in a meeting. That's not the
exactly.
only forum for gaining buy-in.
Exactly. And by the way, what I say is that, you know, the meeting, I just said before that the meeting is no longer a decision-making tool. You know, I think that the idea of actually using the meeting as a forum to actually make the decision is a bad idea. But what I say is the modern meeting is a decision-resolving tool, which is different because a decision resolve really means to come to a final conclusion on, to settle something, you know. And that's where the meeting is useful because I think that the meeting can oftentimes be a great instrument for buy-in. I mean, if you make a decision, for example, that is unpopular or that some people still have some reservations about or concerns about, it might be useful to get them into a room. It might be useful to get them into a room because a lot of times people have concerns and fears that they just want the ability to voice. And a lot of times when you get them in a room, all they want to hear is that the person who's making that decision, one, knows what those concerns are, and two, is willing to take responsibility. You know, a lot of times buy-in can be had just by the leader stepping up and saying, you know what, I know the concerns and I know the risks, and you're going to have to trust me on this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the meeting can be for. I say that the meeting is really useful for conflict, and conflict is something that can actually produce buy-in instead of avoiding it.
Okay. So you mentioned the modern meeting, which is a term that you use in your book
mm-hmm.
and also on your blog. So why don't you start by saying, you know, what is the modern meeting and how should it work?
Well, the modern meeting is the redefinition of what a meeting should be. I say that, you know, the traditional meaning, the way we think of it, has been for traditional times, but we're in a modern era where things are moving quicker than we could have ever imagined, and, you know, we need a new type of meeting. And what I say is that the modern meeting, there's seven principles to a modern meeting, but the first one is the most important, and that is that a modern meeting supports a decision that's already been made. Now, that's fundamentally, you know, 180 from what we think, right? Because we think, like I said before, that the meeting is a decision-making tool. But in modern times, what we need is we need speed and we need innovation. So we need, and this all relies on decision-making. We need decisions to make, we need people to make decisions more quickly, and we need people to make more gutsy decisions, decisions that lead to some type of change and innovation. So if we use the meeting as a tool, as a launching pad for decision, instead of a way to stall, like I said before, you know, the meeting has become a stalling tactic and, you know, you get into a room and diffuse responsibility. Well, if the meeting, the presumption of a meeting is you're meeting and you're in order to resolve a decision or to implement it, well, that's a different story, right? Because now somebody has to step up and make a decision first. You know, you can't even think about a meeting until somebody makes a decision, at least a preliminary decision, and that's the hardest part because somebody stepped up and took accountability, and now the meeting can be a launching pad. You can either resolve that decision, get into a room and discuss whether that's the right one or not, or talk about how you actually coordinate and how you actually move that decision forward. So those are the two primary functions of the modern meeting.
So a question popped into my head, which is, what if you don't have all the information you need to make the decision?
That's a great question.
How do you go about getting it without having a meeting?
Well, there's this incredible tool that it's kind of a new invention that we've forgotten about, and it's called the conversation. It's called the one. You know, I think this one-on-one interaction is not a meeting, and I've made it really abundantly clear in the book that if you look at a one-on-one conversation, it completely is different from the idea of a meeting. The primary reason why a conversation is not a meeting is because the meeting is a weapon of mass interruption, I call it. You know, if you literally are putting six or seven people on hold, you know, interrupting them for what they're doing in order to be able to get them into the room and, you know, acquire some information. But, you know, any meeting can really be thought of as individual conversations. I mean, instead of calling a meeting just to get seven people's feedback, send them an email or call them one-on-one on the phone. Because the great thing about conversations, there's a lot of benefits. One is it's more direct communication. It turns out as soon as that third person enters the fray, it's a meeting and there's an audience and there's grandstanding and blame and diversion. And with one-on-one conversation, there's less of that. I didn't say none, but I did say less. And so if we switch to a mode where we're engaging people more directly, one-on-one, utilizing conversation, I think what we're going to find is we're going to have communication that's more direct and more impactful on making intelligent decisions.
And you're more likely to hear what people really think if it's just a one-on-one
conversation.
Exactly.
That's such a great point, Heather. Like, that's the other thing is this. I think we really in business underestimate the incredible power of groupthink. I mean, we all know what groupthink is, and we all, you know, understand it, but we don't really practically talk about it or think about how it affects our decisions. And it's incredible how pervasive it is. And in a meeting, one person steps up, it's usually somebody with some status, and they say something, and whether you like it or not, whether you're conscious of it or not, your opinion is probably going to be influenced heavily and disproportionately towards what that guy is saying, and the one-on-one conversation kind of avoids that, which is also nice.
So it seems like there are a number of things that are needed to support these modern meetings. What are some of the things that you need to change in the organization in order to make it work?
Well, I mean, there's two ways to think about this, right? The first way to think about it is this is a cultural shift, right? Because this meeting, I think it's a meeting culture that is in organizations where, you know, there's just these common expectations and beliefs in an organization. I mean, that's what a culture is. And the idea is, well, if we can change the culture, like if we change the culture so it's a more decisive culture, then we'll have more decisive meetings. You know, so it's a cause and effect. It's like, okay, well, if we change the culture, then it'll automatically change the meeting. Well, what I'm saying is there's very little, and it's very difficult practically to change a culture. What I'm arguing is there's another relationship, which is if you can change the meetings, you can change how you think about meetings, because it's such an important way of how we do work together, you can actually impact the culture. So what I'm saying is focus on the meetings, focus on how you do meetings. It's a really bite-sized, you know, small way to cause an impact in the culture. So I actually think about it the other way. It's like, if you can kind of start thinking about how you do meetings, it'll actually spread to some of the other areas of the organization. But I'll tell you one thing too, a more kind of practical way for how you can support the modern meeting. And that is no more informational meetings. Like, the other thing that the meeting has become for so long is it's been a communication tool. Mm-hmm. You know, we use it to communicate information. You know, this started out in the factory 50 years ago. If you worked at a factory and the owner needed to tell you something, that's the only way they could do it is through a meeting, right? They would have to come down to the factory floor and then have to tell you all this information, and that's a meeting. But look at where we are right now. I mean, it's been, you know, decades and decades, and we're still doing that. We're still gathering people into a room to tell them things. But we have asynchronous communication now. We have communication that's so effective because we both parties don't have to be engaged at the same time. It's less interruptive. So we have email. We have, you know, like what we're doing right now, we have the ability to record and podcast things and record videos and send it out. So I think one of the main principles of the modern meeting is that they're scarce and there's less of them, because when they're scarce, they feel more special. So I would say that eliminate all the meetings that are informational in nature where they could be done through asynchronous means.
Well, how do you get people to read it or listen or watch?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, one is I would say that what we need to do is we need to create a pact, right? Because what I find the most in my work is that people hate informational meetings. Like, they hate having to sit through somebody just tell them something when they could have been reading it on their BlackBerry on the way home to see their kid. And so if we make a pact with them, we say, listen, we don't like holding these informational meetings as much as you like attending them. If you will read, and you'll read religiously, and we create a culture where we can trust you to read, then, you know, then we can both be happy because we can cancel that. Now, there's some challenges to that, but I would say that one of the key factors that's going to make that work is, one, we have to prioritize our communication. There's so much communication flying back and forth, emails, thousands of them every single day between people, yet we don't give people a good signal as to what's really important and what's not. And so what I would argue is that let's distinguish between a memo and an email. You know, if I send you something, and it's got an attachment in it, and it's a Word document that's nicely spaced out, it's clearly well-written, and, you know, it's cogent and clear. Well, that's a memo, and I'm sending a signal to that person that, listen, you better read this, because this is incredibly important. And when I send you other emails, of course, those are probably important too, but not as important, because if everything's important, then nothing's important. And if we become clear on sending signals to people on what we really need them to read, then I think what you'll find is that they will read that stuff, and you have a much better chance of creating an environment where the informational meeting is no longer necessary.
So in the book, you talked about the difference between a brainstorming meeting, or brainstorm. You didn't even call it a meeting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Brainstorming and having a modern meeting or a decision meeting. Can you tell me what the difference is? How that works?
Yeah, like I think one of the biggest failures is that we've called the brainstorm a meeting, right? Because they're completely different. I mean, what I say is that the meeting has always been about evaluating choices and really getting to the root of, you know, what we should really do and how we should act. But the brainstorm is not like that. The brainstorm is supposed to be a place for pure creativity, and where we're supposed to imagine, where we're supposed to come up with as many possibilities as possible. So how come when I'm walking down the hallway at your office, I can't tell whether you're having a brainstorm or a meeting? Like, they should look completely different. And if you look at some of the top companies in the world, like Audio, which is the top creative firm, which is, I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners are familiar with, they do brainstorms completely different. So why aren't we doing that too? And the other thing I'll say is that when you look at solving any type of problem, there's two phases. Think about writing, for example. Any productive writer knows that if you try to write and edit at the same time, you're going to go crazy and you're not really going to do well, right? Because that uses two different areas, two different hemispheres of the brain. You know, writing and creation is one, and then the editing, the deletion part, is another one. Yet, think about how we solve problems. There's a problem to be had, and then we pile into a room, and we just try to solve it instead of realizing that there's two parts. The first one is to brainstorm as many options and possibilities as possible to solve that problem. And the second phase is actually to come to the conclusion and settle on which is the right problem and which is the right path. And so if we realize that the brainstorm is really good for the first part and the meeting is really good for the second part, that's going to cause a lot of breakthroughs in how we approach problem solving.
Sure, they require totally different mindsets. Switching back and forth, especially, I know it does not work.
Exactly, because as soon as one person starts evaluating, as soon as that one person in the brainstorm starts to say, you know what, that I don't really like that idea, it's over. It's over. You know, the entire culture of that session is dead because people now are afraid to be creative.
Right. So changing the way that you do meetings is a change unto itself, even though it might support the change that you're trying to create. So how would you suggest someone go about bringing this to their organization?
Well, this is a movement. And if you look at how any movement has ever gotten a hold and started, it's because a few people, a loud minority, were passionate about a certain thing, and it spreads. And the great thing about meetings is you can't do them without other people. So it's literally it's got a viral element to it. So if you change the way that you do meetings and you change the way you show up to other people's meetings. So, for example, let's say you get an invitation for a meeting to go to next week. You have the ability to do something about that, you know? Like, I feel like we've gotten into this world where the invitation is like a subpoena to testify at court, where you just show up or else you get arrested. I mean, that's ridiculous. Like, you can negotiate with the person who's holding the meeting. You can take them aside and diplomatically say, hey, by the way, just curious, are you sure that maybe I can contribute to this meeting just via a one-on-one conversation? Like, maybe we just have a conversation first, and then I might not even have to go to the meeting, or you might not even have to have the meeting, you know? So impacting the way that those meetings are run before they even start is critical. And the other way is when you're holding a meeting is to really think about how you're doing it and what signals you're sending, you know? Like, one of the things I tell people, which is kind of a silly thing, but it's a tactical thing, is try having your meetings be odd times. Like, try having your meeting as a 23-minute meeting. And people might think you're crazy, but what it does is sends a signal. It says, what's gotten into John today? I mean, that's different. 23 minutes, that's weird. One, it sends a signal that time is important and every minute counts. But two, it opens up a conversation. You know, now he's going to ask you, why did you choose to do a 23-minute meeting? And then you could tell him about how the meeting has changed and how time is important and we need to really use the meeting as a way to resolve decisions, and that's how this thing is going to spread.
Yeah, there's no reason we have to stay here until 10:30 or until the top of the hour just because that's when time randomly occurs, you know.
Exactly.
Okay. So beyond that, I mean, would you say that getting leaders involved in the new meeting culture, or is it just, you know, start with the meetings that you have, the people that are in your meetings, or the meetings that you're invited to? Do you expand beyond that at all? Or yeah, at what point does it do you need to expand beyond that?
I mean, absolutely. Listen, you know, I think that if you can approach leadership about this and really make the case and champion this effort, I don't know of any effort that's more important and that's more impactful in an organization than this, and I encourage that. But you have to. But this is really, really important, and I don't think people get this, and so I'm going to say it really clearly here, is even if the CEO got involved and made a public decree and said, we are now doing the modern meeting standard, that's the way we're doing things from now on, even if that happened, it probably wouldn't fix the problem. It might help, but the problem is you can't force a culture. You can't, you know, outlaw or regulate a culture, because people are going to do what they're going to do. And so what you have to do is you have to inspire them. You have to, you know, get them to embrace this organically. And I think how that happens is usually from the bottom up. It's from people like the ones that are listening to this program, you know, really having these authentic one-on-one conversations with people and getting them to understand the vision behind this and why this is so important. And once you do, when you get to 100 monkeys, you know, what we find in social psychology is that there's a tipping point. There's a tipping point where when you get enough people involved and you form a coalition where all these people are bought into this idea, it could spread like wildfire, and overnight you could have everybody that is really bought into this and really understands how important this is to the organization. So I'd say that for the people and the meeting culture warriors out there who are interested in changing these organizations, especially big ones, focus on the first 100 monkeys, because if you can get the 100 monkeys, you might find that literally the other ones will follow in a matter of time.
We won't tell everybody else we're calling them monkeys, right?
just really quickly, there's a parable. It's called it's the 100 monkey effect, and there's a guy named John Keyes who wrote about how there's an island of monkeys, and as soon as he got to the 100th one, boom, the entire island changed. And not only did the island change, but other islands that weren't even connected changed those monkeys as well. So I love that parable because it really underscores the social phenomenon that we don't have to get everyone. We just have to get the critical mass for the entire culture to change.
Great. So where can people find out more about this concept and your book?
My website is modernmeetingstandard.com. If you just Google modern meeting, I'll show up. And that's where I write, and, you know, you can find information about my book. And there's also a really quickly, when you sign up for the website, there's actually a webinar that I did with Seth Godin that I feel like really, really people are really delighted by that. So if you do that and listen to that, I think you can get a little more information on how this change thing works with meetings.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here, Al. I appreciate your time, and your book is great. I recommend it to the people who are listening. And is it available in, is it just an ebook, or is it available in hard?
Nope, it's available hardcover, audio, okay, and Kindle version.
Okay, because I know I read mine on the Kindle.
Great. I like the Kindle myself. So
I recommend it, and thank you so much for being here and for sharing these great concepts with us.
Thank you, Heather. It's a pleasure.
The next episode is coming up on Tuesday, February 21st, 2012, at 11 a.m. Eastern. My guest is Dr. Trina Hess from the Humor Academy. She's going to tell us about how to laugh our way through change. So hopefully I won't have a giggle fit in the middle of that one. In the meantime, if you would like to find more resources and learn how we might work together to help you influence change in your organization, please visit www.enclaria.com. Thank you for listening to The Change Agent's Dilemma. Take care and best wishes for your change initiative.
Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head to head. So you'll be.
Happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
Using an overpriced trash bag.
Pricey, pricey, pricey!
A bag that breaks.
Whippy, whippy, whippy!
Or a smelly bag.
Stinky, stinky, stinky!
Time to switch to Hefty Ultra Strong trash bags, always at an ultra low price.
Hefty, hefty, hefty!
They're our best bags yet, and they cost less than Glad ForceFlex were sold head to head. So you'll be.
Happy, happy, happy!
Hefty Ultra Strong with Arm & Hammer Odor Control. Available at Sam's Club.
Hefty, hefty, hefty! Yeah.